The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated December 30, 2024. Bordered in red on the front cover with a narrow white inner border. Person of the Year is in bold white print, right above Time in large capital block letters. Time is in blue-gray tones, and it's superimposed upon gradated blue-gray to white tones, featuring Donald Trump on the cover in a dark blue suit, white shirt, and red tie. I'll also be reading to you from the edition of Time from May 27, 2024. Beginning then with the December 30 issue, this, of course, features throughout the issue the best of something, according to Time Magazine. What we have here is a section entitled The Best of Television and Movies and Books and Podcasts and Music and Culture. The art that entertained, moved, and inspired us in 2024. Again, that's according to Time Magazine. Television, movies, books, podcasts, music, and culture. Turning the page to movies. And these reviews are provided by Stephanie Zakarik, and there are two pages of them. 10 items. 1, baby girl, that is one word. If you read only the synopsis of baby girl before seeing it, you might imagine it's an erotic age gap thriller about the workplace power dynamic between men and women. That is part of it, sure. But Halina Rain's exuberant third feature goes deeper than that, exploring the ways in which human beings, especially women, often want things they don't know how to ask for. Nicole Kidman gives a live-wire performance as Romy, a buttoned-up executive who falls under the spell of a seductive intern, Harris Dickinson, a bedroom murmur in human form. There's so much we don't know about desire, particularly in perimenopausal and menopausal women, and almost nobody wants to talk about it except Rain, and that is spelled R-E-I-J-N. The movie's centerpiece, built around George Michael's father figure, is one of the most rapturous sequences put to film this year, a celebration of what it means to finally, or at least temporarily, know yourself. Number 2, all we imagine as light. Everywhere you look, there are women living on their own, making their lives work in spite of long hours at their jobs, thwarted love, loneliness. In Payal Kapadia's gorgeous study of friendship and the tensions that sometimes come with it, three women in modern Mumbai chart their own bumpy roads. Prabha, Connie Kusruti, a nurse, is married, but she has not heard from her absentee husband in years. Fellow nurse Anu, Divya Prabha, is secretly involved with a Muslim man, which she must hide from her Hindu family, and just about everybody, at all costs. And Parvati Shaya Kadam is an older hospital worker who loses her home because the property's paperwork is in her late husband's name. All of these women have come from small villages to work, to make money, to do things their own way. Kapadia captures the texture of their lives, as well as the glittery, gritty poetry of the city around them. 3, the seed of the sacred fig. What happens when a country becomes desperate to control women, believing it has every right to do so? Iranian filmmaker Mohammad Rasoulov's shattering film offers one possible answer. A loyal government servant, Misag Zarez Iman, has just been promoted to the position of investigating judge. A huge move up for him. His wife, Naima Sohaila Golestani, and their two teenage daughters, Rezvan Masa Rostami and Sana Satara Maleki. This is what you'd call a close, loving family, but Rezvan and Sana come to see the insidiousness of the comfortable lives their father's job has accorded them. Their awareness ignites a kind of explosion. Rasoulov fled Iran last spring, just before this film was to make its premiere at Cannes, after the Islamic Republic, displeased with the content of his films, handed him an 8-year prison sentence. This film, made in the aftermath of Mahsa Amini's 2022 death in police custody after she was arrested for how she wore her hijab, is a thriller, a family drama, and a horror story, but mostly it's an invocation to fight back. 4. Anora, A-N-O-R-A. Sean Baker's story of an effervescent young sex worker, Ani, Mikey Madison, who meets and falls for the rambunctious son of a Russian oligarch, spoiled rich kid Ivan, Mark Edelstein, is part romantic comedy, part fractured fairy tale, one that focuses on what happens after the golden coach turns back into a pumpkin. That is the magic of writer-director Baker, a workaday humanist whose quiet generosity sneaks up on you, and Madison's performance, both ebullient and piercing, is one of the year's finest. 5. A Complete Unknown. James Mangold's scrappy patchwork portrait of Bob Dylan's early years in New York is not a biopic. It is a Dylan cover, an interpretation of real events, filtered through memory, myth, and pure fabrication. But can you, should you, fact-check a ballad? Timothée Chalamet slouches through the movie with inquisitive, appraising eyes. Yet this film really belongs to the women, Monica Barbaro as superfamous folk singer Joan Baez and Ella Fanning as Sylvie Russo, based on Susie Rotolo, an early Dylan muse, but also a shrewd chronicler of the scene. These are women living in the real world. Meanwhile, the man himself sits on a rumpled bed, writing one of the world's greatest protest songs in his underpants. As the title suggests, you will know less about the real Bob Dylan coming out of a complete unknown than you did going in. But do you think the actual Bob, who gave Mangold notes on the script, considers knowing everything about everything a worthy goal? There's a song that goes, "He not busy being born." You probably know the rest. Number 6, Hard Truths. Mike Lee is the closest we have got to a modern Dickens, a filmmaker whose portrayals of complex, difficult, often unlikable people come to feel like family portraits. They may make us cringe, but we can see bits of ourselves there, too. Marion Jean-Baptiste, so extraordinary, in Lee's 1996 Secrets and Lies, plays Pansy, a woman who appears to be held together by her anger. She bristles with bitterness every minute. No one, including her husband, David Weber, and son, Tuane Barrett, can stand to be around her for long. Jean-Baptiste softens nothing about Pansy. Her performance is raw as a bundle of thorns, fierce and uncompromising. We never find out what makes Pansy the way she is, and there's no comforting redemption arc. Still, somehow, we reach out to her in her unnameable pain. Lee does not give up on her, and neither can we. 7 Green Border, a serious-minded film about the plight of refugees trying to cross into Europe from the Middle East and Africa, is a tough sell. But Agnieszka Holland's film, though at times hard to watch, is so beautifully made and so attuned to all the things we respond to as humans who care about art's entwinement with real life, that it is ultimately more joyful than dispiriting. Sometimes movies about difficult subjects end up being such brutal experiences, you almost wish you had not seen them. Green Border is the opposite. It's likely to leave you feeling emboldened and galvanized, if also a little sadder and wiser. Number 8. Emilia Perez. In Jacques Audiard's extravagantly emotional opera, Emilia Perez, Zoe Saldana plays Rita, a disillusioned lawyer working in Mexico, who's asked to undertake a strange task. A ruthless drug lord, Manitas, wants to transition to living as a woman and needs Rita to arrange both the surgery and subsequent disappearance. She pulls it off and thinks she's through with the job, but the woman Manitas has become, now named Emilia Perez, both roles are played by the fantastic Spanish actress Carla Sofia Gascon, reemerges asking Rita's help in righting some of her past wrongs. Emilia Perez is great fun, but it's also about personal transformation as a beginning, not an end, an exhortation to leave the world in better shape than you found it. It is a film with an open heart, arriving at a time when so many human hearts seem to have shut down. 9. Flow, F-L-O-W. This wordless, animated wonder from Latvia, directed by Gints Zilbalodis, follows a nameless black cat as he travels across a flooded world in a boat shared by a stalwart capybara, a clumsy friendly dog, an opportunistic lemur, and a stately secretary bird. Elegant and spare, this is an environmental parable that does not hammer away at its message. Instead, it gently reminds us that the beauty of this world is worth preserving. 10. Dogman, that's one word. French filmmaker Luc Besson has long specialized in fantastic flights of fantasy and shockeroo violence, but he's never made a film as tender as Dogman. Caleb Landry Jones Douglas is a wounded human being, a survivor of childhood abuse who finds solace in living with his community of dogs. Dogman is about the families we choose, sometimes more sustaining than the ones we are born into. It's also the perfect movie for those days you are convinced that dogs are better than people, even if that is every day. Turning now to another The Best Of series, another 10, and this is TV shows. Then I'll take a break from The Best Ofs by Judy Berman. Number 1, Shogun, an artistic triumph, a record-breaking 18 Emmy wins, an all-time viewership high for FX. Two more seasons in development for a title that was planned as a limited series. By every measure, Shogun is the TV success story of 2024. It was not a foregone conclusion that a $200 million bet on a largely Japanese language production that was also the second high-profile adaptation of James Clavell's 1975 bestseller about a 17th century English sailor, Cosmo Jarvis, who washes up in Japan and finds himself at the mercy of a politically isolated feudal lord. Hiroyuki Sanada was going to pay off, but at a time when American audiences are assumed to have fragmented along demographic and partisan lines, creators Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo scored a mega hit by offering something precious to every kind of viewer: heroism, history, romance, magnificent performances, lush visuals. As streamers increasingly turn away from ambitious projects in their desperation to get out of the red, I hope Shogun will resonate as a reminder that Fortune Favors the Bold, and that's FX. Number two, industry. Industry has always been better than its reputation, as that show where young finance employees in London snort coke, sleep around, and take reckless risks with staggering sums of money. Not that that's technically incorrect, but with this year's third season, Mickey Down and Conrad Kay's propulsive drama became one of TV's shrewdest commentaries on the times in which we are living. Opening with the calamitous IPO of a green energy startup managed by the series' fictional banking giant, Pierpont and Company, the season took a scalpel to socially conscious capitalism. At the same time, it zoomed in on some of its most compelling characters, troubled heiress Yasmin, Marisa Abela, cutthroat company man Eric, Ken Lung, toxic striver Rishi, Sagar Radia. Taken together, these arcs and the overarching plot demonstrate how, at a place like Pierpont, when self-interest conflicts with decency, selfishness always wins. And that's HBO. Three, Say Nothing. What happened to Jean McConville, the widowed mother of 10, who vanished in 1972? After being abducted from her Belfast home? This question ostensibly drives FX's adaptation of the acclaimed nonfiction book by Patrick Radden Keefe. But Say Nothing barely resembles the typical true crime drama. Morally astute, rich in layered characters and insightful performances, and perceptive about how a person's morals evolve with age, the series filters four decades of The Troubles through the experience of Dolores Price, Lola Pettigrew, an IRA agitator who spent her later life, in which she is played by Maxine Peake, haunted by her extremist youth. At its core, the show is really asking, who benefits from political violence? Who becomes its collateral damage? FX. Four, Penelope. It says nothing good about the state of TV that filmmaker and actor Mark Duplass, who created Penelope with Mel Eslin, pitched the series to studios but wound up producing it independently when none would bite. Thankfully, Netflix did license the final product, a dreamlike half-hour drama that follows a teenage girl, played by magnetic Megan Stott, who abruptly leaves home to rough it in Cascade National Forest. Rendered in vibrant shades of green and generous with moments of silence, Penelope's journey is best understood as a spiritual pilgrimage. Like Thoreau, she goes to the woods to live deliberately. And by immersing us in its heroine's search for meaning, the show invites our introspection as well. Netflix. Five, Phantasmas. When reality feels like a fever dream, surreal stories can hit harder than realism. Hence the haunting humor of Phantasmas, an unconventional sketch comedy about art and survival from the infinite imagination of Julio Torres, Los Espookys Problemista. The show's fantastical vignettes feature a delightful guest star lineup, Tilda Swinton, Steve Buscemi, executive producer Emma Stone. But what has stuck with me is the frame narrative, starring Torres as Julio, a creative wunderkind living in an alternate universe, New York. When a health scare and landlord trouble throw his life into precarity, Julio's plight is exacerbated by his refusal to obtain an invasive new form of ID called proof of existence. His only other option is to earn enough money through selling dumb TV show ideas about his gay and Latino identities to live on his own terms. Absurd though it is, his predicament makes perfect sense as a metaphor for the artist's endless battle against bureaucracy, mediocrity, and poverty, not to mention a sharp commentary on the current TV landscape. From HBO. Six, Somebody, Somewhere. For a few years, at the very peak of Peak TV, you could not browse a streaming service menu without stumbling upon a witty, wise, alternately warm, and wry slice-of-life comedy whose modest scale belied its universal insight. One of the last left standing until its December 8 finale was Somebody Somewhere, which cast New York alt-cabaret doyen Bridget Everett as a single, unmoored, middle-aged woman in small-town Kansas. A celebration of friendships that become chosen families and intrafamilial feuds that resolve into friendships, it illustrates how finding community can change a person's life. The show's third and final season, which finds Everett's Sam flirting with romance as her pals settle down with partners of their own, poignantly captures the common fear that everyone in your life is moving forward while you stay stuck in the same stunted place. HBO. 7. Interview with the Vampire. Interview with the Vampire, the flagship title in AMC's Anne Rice franchise, is the rare reboot with something new to offer. What began as the warped saga of conflicted vampire Lewis, Jacob Anderson, and his abusive but devoted maker, Lestat, Sam Reed, evolved in this year's second season into TV's most bizarre love triangle, as we got to know Lewis's mysteriously powerful current beau, Asad Zaman. A capital R romantic spirit suffuses creator Roland Jones' production, which feels emotionally immersive in ways that so much recent entertainment for adults is not. That's AMC. 8. The Sympathizer. Yes, it casts one of the biggest movie stars in the world, Robert Downey Jr., in a quadruple role that collectively represents white supremacy. And yes, he's great. But what is really remarkable about Park Chan-wook's wild, globe-spanning, maniacal, referential, simultaneously hilarious, and gutting adaptation of the Pulitzer-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen is its insight into the Vietnam War, a cataclysm that shaped identities both Vietnamese and American. Grounded in the chronically ambivalent perspective of the captain, a note-perfect Hoa Juanda, The Sympathizer spans continents as it reckons with what it means to commit to a cause and how a society survives colonialism, war, and ideological schism. That's HBO. 9. Baby Reindeer. No one was betting on a trauma-driven dramedy adapted from an unknown Scottish creator's autobiographical one-man show to become Netflix's big 2024 breakout. But such is the magic of Netflix, which through a unique combination of algorithmic wizardry and word-of-mouth virality has the power to spawn global hits nobody saw coming. Now the show's mastermind and star, Richard Gadd, is a household name. With an armload of awards and an HBO series in the works, it could not have happened to a more compelling voice. Nominally a crime drama that fictionalizes his ordeal with a female stalker, Jessica Gunning, his sui generis series is really a journey into a wounded psyche, dissecting everything from Gad's self-involvement to his history with a sexually abusive mentor to his inability to commit to a trans woman, Nava Mao, who's too good for him. Also, it's funny. Netflix. And finally, 10, Pachinko, P-A-C-H-I-N-K-O. In its superior second season, this epic adaptation of Min Jin Lee's novel about a Korean family in the 20th century reaches the book's powerful middle chapters, which trace its heroine Sunya, Min-ha Kim, conflicted relationship with her secret lover turned guardian angel, Mr. Ko, Lee Min Ho, during World War II. creator Sue Hugh weaves together the family's struggles with a fresh perspective on a conflict that made Korean immigrants collateral damage of their occupiers' aggression. While deepening the first season's depiction of her grandson Solomon, Jin Ha, wrestling with his identity, history, ambition, and future two generations later, a tale that pits survival against self-sacrifice and legacy against self-determination, Pachinko doesn't just do justice to the contemporary classic it is based on, it forges new connections and finds new revelations. That's from Apple TV Plus. Moving backward now to the May 27, 2024 edition of Time. Under the heading World Uranium Dreams, the promise of clean nuclear power brings the West to Mongolia. This is by Charlie Campbell. Sinshand, Mongolia. The Gobi Desert, once revered by Mongolian poet Dulduitan Dansaravya as hiding a cosmic portal to the heavenly kingdom of Shambhala, was transformed in the 20th century from spiritual energy to fossil fuel hub. Wild rabbits and donkeys shared the windswept dunes with rusting oil pumps, while an endless caravan of soot-stained trucks haul coal south to the border with China. Now the Gobi is on the cusp of another reincarnation, one that its supporters believe could help future-proof the global energy landscape. In October, the French state-owned nuclear firm Orano signed a $1.7 billion deal to extract and process uranium from the Zubch Uvu mine, not 2 hours by car from the landmarked site of Dansaravya's cosmic portal. Mongolia's first uranium mine is expected to produce about 2,750 tons annually for three decades, some 4% of global production. It's currently one of the top 10 unexploited deposits worldwide. This deposit is far from the only one, says Olivier Tumir, a senior vice president for Orano. There's huge potential in Mongolia to enter the uranium market at the right time because we know needs are going to increase. Mongolia boasts the world's second largest uranium reserves, which promise to catapult this landlocked nation of 3.5 million into position as a key player in the global renewable energy transition. Catalyzed by the war in Ukraine and Europe's desire to wean itself off cheap Russian gas, support is booming for clean nuclear energy, which generates electricity by splitting atoms of uranium or plutonium. The enthusiasm must overcome deep anxiety over reactor meltdowns such as those at Chernobyl in 1986 and Fukushima in 2011, questions about the disposal of nuclear waste, and the potential for plants to be targets of war or terrorism. But historic fatalities across seven decades of the civil nuclear industry are measured in the low thousands. Meanwhile, air pollution from burning fossil fuels is estimated to cause 5 million deaths every year. Today, nations from Romania and Saudi Arabia to Bangladesh and Indonesia are exploring nuclear plants. The EU has included nuclear power plants in its list of green investments that can be funded by its own green bonds, given the energy produced boasts just a quarter of the carbon footprint of even solar. At COP28, more than 20 countries across four continents asked to triple the world's nuclear energy capacity by 2050. Even Germany, which shuttered most of its 17 reactors after Fukushima, is now openly considering developing small modular reactors. Today, we probably have more of a problem of capacity than public acceptance, says Tumir. Diversifying uranium supplies also makes sense for the U.S., despite strict sanctions on oil and gas over Vladimir Putin's war of choice. The first 6 months of 2023 saw Russian shipments of enriched uranium to America's 92 commercial nuclear reactors more than double, to $695.5 million. Legislation to curb this supply passed the Senate last April, though experts predict it will take at least 5 years of heavy investment for the U.S. to break its Russian uranium dependency. Mongolia can help in that regard if it steps lightly. It may be an adolescent, rambunctious democracy, but a nation squeezed between Russia and China, and whose capital, Ulaanbaatar, literally translates as Red Hero, cannot shrug off historical and geopolitical baggage so easily. Since democratization in 1990, Mongolia has cultivated ties with the West via its third neighbor policy, of which the Orano deal is a prime example. But a nation reliant on Beijing for 90% of trade and Moscow for 90% of imported gas and petroleum must tread carefully in this fraught new era of great power competition. Russia feels Mongolia's mines are really their assets because Soviet money was invested into them, says Ken DeGroff, former vice chairman of the North America-Mongolia Business Council. Mongolia is an acute illustration of the geopolitical, environmental, and economic challenges facing mineral-rich nations seeking to benefit from emerging technologies, whether supplying indium for flat-screen TVs, rhenium for jet engines, or gallium for smartphones. With mining already accounting for a quarter of GDP and 90% of exports, the hope in Mongolia is that this generation of energy extraction works out better than the last. The nation remains blighted by endemic poverty, and because of a reliance on coal for heat and power, some of the planet's most rancid air. Over the past decade, respiratory diseases in Ulaanbaatar, the world's most polluted capital, have increased nearly threefold, with pneumonia the second leading cause of death among young children today. Miscarriages are 3.5 times as common in Ulaanbaatar's polluted winter as in the comparatively clear summer. But resource exploitation is a charged issue in Mongolia, a third of whose people are nomadic and fiercely protective of ancestral lands, worshipping the eternal blue sky and considering even a shallow trench a shameful defiling of Mother Earth. The challenge for Mongolia's government is to safely harness the benefits of the resource boom while mitigating pushback within its borders and beyond. I am confident that we will have a successful cooperation with Orano, Mongolian Prime Minister Oyan Erdena, Luvsanamazri tells Time. But it's important for us to have public acceptance so that the project can be legitimate among the people of Mongolia. Securing that legitimacy has been a key focus for Orano, which formed a local joint venture, Bodrock Energy, to run Zuvch-Uvu alongside Mongolian state mining company Erdene's Mongol LLC. Orano began exploring the Gobi back in 1997, discovering its first uranium deposits in 2006 and obtaining licenses in 2016. It then built a pilot project to demonstrate feasibility, producing 11 tons of uranium over 18 months during 2021 and 2022. The pilot project remains staffed by a skeleton crew. Though the site will likely be used for training the 800 permanent staff for full mine, construction of which is slated to take 3 or 4 years. practically all Zuchovo's neighbors are nomads who live in gers, otherwise known as yurts, felt-covered domed tents of latticed wood with central dung-burning stoves. Mongolians assemble their gers to face south to catch the light. They can be easily transported on camels to follow grazing herds and reassembled in under an hour. It is a harsh existence, with temperatures in the Gobi plunging to minus 40 Fahrenheit in the winter and soaring to 113 Fahrenheit during summer. Gers, that's G-E-R-S, are still constructed as they have been for millennia, albeit now with solar-powered televisions, refrigerators, and Wi-Fi connections. When Orano first set up camp nearby, the herders were suspicious, unnerved by alarmist social media posts that incorrectly suggested radiation from uranium could cause mutations in livestock. Toxic waste is a concern nuclear power plants must deal with, but mining raw uranium exposes workers to far less radiation than a job as a hospital radiologist would. Staff would be chased away by furious locals who hurled dead animals, and once even a Molotov cocktail into the mine's compound. It did not help that Mongolia's first COVID-19 case was an Orano employee visiting from France, a fact that energized demonstrations. But a slow and steady outreach program has quelled concerns. Orano committed to putting $1 million annually into community projects near Zuchovo, whose pilot site welcomed 670 visitors in 2023, herders, students, and NGOs, to whom the company strove to explain the mining process. There were a lot of rumors at the start about animals dying, says a herder's wife, Savelma Narantagul, as she plays by her gear with her three-year-old son. Urmumbleg, proudly showing off his Spider-Man pajamas. But it's been years now and nothing has happened. To be sure, history is rife with examples of supposed progress whose real harms have not become clear till decades later, to wit, climate change. No fewer are the examples of damage done by those who seek that progress to peoples who live more in sync with the earth. But it helps that Zuchovo is far from a conventional mine. The uranium deposit lies some 2 to 5 miles below the surface and is sandwiched between two thick layers of clay. This distinct geography allows in-situ recovery, or ISR, a leaching process during which acidified water is pumped deep to the deposit via narrow vertical tubes. The acid dissolves the uranium before being retrieved at the surface via a network of outlet pipes. The uranium is then removed and processed into yellow cake, a low-grade form with the claggy texture of spent coffee grounds. Eventually, this can be enriched into fuel rods. It is, in theory, a closed-loop process where vital groundwater is completely sealed from possible contaminants. What is more, there's no gaping quarry, pit, tunnels, diggers, noise, dust, or choking diesel emissions. The only evidence of this mine without a mine, as Orano likes to put it, is a network of stumpy pipes poking out of the surface of the desert, through which camels and horses can wander just as before. While mining operations occur across a concession of some 35 acres, only a tiny section used for production facilities and crew housing is fenced off. Still, the project's been dogged by controversy. In 2018, French prosecutors began investigating Orano for alleged bribery of a public official in Mongolia involving a third-party consulting firm. Orano says it's cooperating with the ongoing investigation. The French anti-nuclear network, Sortir du Nucléaire, has criticized the leaching process for the quantities of acid used. And in 2018, a group of Mongolian citizens filed a complaint against Bodrock Energy, alleging a spike in livestock malformations as well as cancers and miscarriages nearby. In response, Orano points to independent monitoring by Mongolia's Academy of Sciences that found no discernible impact to local water, soil, air, or vegetation. That hasn't stopped traders and rival herders from leveraging the mine to barter down the price for local animals. People say our meat is toxic because of the uranium, says Monk Shuri Dambadarja, 41, a herder who grazes his 1,500 cows, horses, sheep, goats, and camels next to Zuvich Uvu. But if so, how come we're still alive? Nuclear power and the mining projects necessary to fuel it will always have detractors. However, the Gobi's increasingly problematic winters have inadvertently served as a propaganda tool. During the harsh season, herders now bring their animals to the plant's gates to ask if they can shelter inside. We have to say no, it is an industrial facility, says Enktulga Gontulga, a sustainability and community affairs manager for Orano. But it shows acceptance has completely changed. The herders have always contended with ZUDs, D-Z-U-D-S, severe winters that arrive after summer droughts and trigger widespread animal death. But global warming has exacerbated this phenomena. Average temperatures in Mongolia are already 2 degrees centigrade warmer than at the start of the 20th century, more severe than the global average, meaning drier weather, more frequent dust storms, and sparser grasslands for grazing animals to acquire the fat necessary to survive longer winters. This year was a particularly bad ZUD, which affected over 90% of the country and killed over 4.7 million animals, as pastures were buried in snow and ice. At least 2,250 herder families lost over 70% of their livestock. When time visited Zuvich Uvu last February, the adjacent land was strewn with frozen gazelles and cows, tongues protruding in grim rictus. The frequency of ZUDs has brought home to Mongolia's rural population what has become irrefutable to its urban dwellers. The climate crisis is deadly, and clean energy vital to mitigate its ravages. Mongolia's coal addiction is especially perverse, considering the bounty of clean power at its disposal. Whereas coal last year accounted for over half of Mongolia's total $15.2 billion export revenue, the hope is that future mining projects can enhance rather than impair quality of life. Orano says running Zuvich Uvu will require only 12 megawatts MW of electricity, of which 5 megawatts will be generated by harnessing the heat produced by the on-site sulfuric acid plant. The remaining 7 megawatts will, it says, likely come from a nearby wind farm. Orano's business is to produce decarbonized energy, so we need to be consistent, says Mark Millard, CEO of Bodrock Energy. Along with subterranean uranium deposits, the Gobi also offers tremendous solar and wind potential. Back in 2011, SoftBank CEO Masayoshi Son even proposed an Asian supergrid linking China, Japan, South Korea, and as far south as Singapore to solar and wind farms blanketing the Gobi. Although such grandiose plans have stalled, Mongolia remains committed to becoming a net zero economy by 2050 and hopes to set international standards for responsible resource exploitation. The journey's just starting because of the global decarbonization shift, says Orchlan Engstetseg, a former mining executive who founded renewable energy startup Eureka, U-R-E-C-A. So how do we put in policies now so Mongolia is positioned as the most economically competitive place to buy renewable energy from? Yet competition also brings challenges. Orano is 90% owned by the French government, and Tumir insists Zhivchovo will certainly contribute to the energy security of Europe. But Mongolia's uranium requires processing at one of the dozen or so enrichment facilities around the world, and the closest are in Russia and China. Even if Orano wanted to ship elsewhere, Mongolia's geography necessitates using Chinese ports. Oyan Erdena insists our two immediate neighbors do not interfere in our domestic affairs. But few believe Mongolia would be immune to pressure if the West's relations with Moscow and Beijing continue to deteriorate. When it comes to resources and energy, when is geopolitics not involved? Asks Engstetseg pointedly. Recent experience also makes mining a contentious topic in domestic Mongolian politics, especially as parliamentary elections occur. Resource development is probably the biggest dilemma that we're facing as a country, says Amarjan Nebkabayar, an advisor to the chairman of the Democratic Party of Mongolia. Mongolia boasts significant deposits of gold, copper, phosphorus, zinc, and lithium, as well as coal and uranium. The impetus is to not repeat mistakes of the past, says Oyan Erdena. It's very important to go step by step. Whereas Mongolia spent profligately during its previous mining boom, Oyan Erdena says future revenues will be put into a sovereign wealth fund and used to expand other sectors like agriculture and tourism so we can diversify our economy. Orano has so far plowed $250 million into its Mongolia operation without earning a cent. Since 2006, it's launched over 300 projects, including new community centers for herders and planting 20,000 native saxal bushes to combat desertification. In the nearest town of Ulaanbaatar, last year alone, Orano helped renovate the hospital, meeting hall, museum, and school, which has 226 students, 8 to 14 years old. Orano purchased 14 computers for the school in 2016 and is about to replace them for the third time. Touring the dozen immaculate classrooms flanked by trophies and crayon drawings of Bart Simpson, the head teacher asked the tidily dressed children if they've heard of Orano. "Yes, it bought the minibus," shouts one student. "The whiteboard," chimes in another. "And the books," says a third. The teacher uses our visit to make a spirited argument for why her charges also need tablets. In the Gobi, Orano operates as almost a state within a state. When the local governor needs something, he does not approach the cash-strapped central government. He goes directly to the mine. Time saw a petition from the Mongolian military asking Orano for funds to repair the border fence. The seemingly endless flow of cash has engendered a sense of dependence and perhaps inevitably resentment. McLeod admits that were Orano a private rather than state-owned firm, it probably would have abandoned Mongolia long ago. "It's already 27 years with only expenses," he says with a Gallic shrug. "It is really too long." Such delays are very specific to Mongolia, he laments, as our train rolls out of Sanshand Station. Behind us, Donzanravja's cosmic portal and its ethereal promise of Shambhala fades into gloom. But the prospect of a better tomorrow springing from the Gobi feels very real and very close, if only today can first be secured. That lengthy article was only slightly abridged. Returning now to the December 30 edition of Time and the books list. Again, there are 10 of them, but we won't read them all. Annabel Guterman writes this review. Fiction 1, James. Percival Everett's reimagining of Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, which won a National Book Award, is a sweeping story centering on Jim, the enslaved sidekick in Mark Twain's classic adventure tale. Everett sends both Huck Finn and his friend, reintroduced as James, down the Mississippi River as he pokes holes in the 1884 novel and paints the original protagonist's companion as a perceptive observer of danger, humanity, and language. Number 2, We Were the Universe. Leaving her young daughter and husband at home in Texas, Kit goes on a retreat with her best friend in Montana. The getaway is fun, until a drunken night suddenly reminds Kimberly King Parsons' overwhelmed protagonist of her dead sister, Julie. When she returns home, Kit feels Julie's presence everywhere, and her world begins to warp. 3, Beautyland, one word. Raised by a single mother, Adina Giorno enjoys a childhood marked by the usual things, going to school, making friends, as well as an uncanny ability to communicate with extraterrestrial life via a fax machine. As Adina grows, she reports on the people she observes with a clarity that's often hilarious. Through Adina's eyes, Marie-Helene Bertino unveils a sweet and strange exploration on what it means to be human. 4, Fire Exit. For years, Charles has kept a watchful eye over his daughter, who lives on the nearby Penobscot Reservation and has no idea her father is a white man. He catches glimpses of Elizabeth's life from his porch across the river and yearns to know her. When she suddenly disappears, Charles decides to take matters in Morgan Talty's haunting book about heritage and belonging. 5, All Fours, F-O-U-R-S. Miranda July's second novel begins as a 45-year-old woman leaves her child and husband at home in Los Angeles to go on a cross-country drive to New York City. But less than an hour outside town, she pulls off the freeway and into a motel where an unexpected love affair with a younger man steers her thrillingly off course. 6, Martyr, with an exclamation point. Stumbling through his days as a hospital actor, Cyrus travels to the Brooklyn Museum, where a terminally ill artist has put herself on display. Cyrus, recently sober and obsessed with death, has lived a life punctuated by loss, beginning as a baby when his mother perished in a plane crash. Kava Akbar pulls these characters closer together in a story that is both a multi-generational family saga and a portrait of a young man attempting to make sense of life. 7, The Book of Love. In Kelly Link's debut novel, 3 teenagers are resurrected from the dead and given the chance to return to their lives, but they cannot all stay for good. The trio is tasked with completing magical tasks in order to earn a place back in their sleepy Massachusetts town. The Book of Love is funny and whimsical as the characters harness fantastical powers. Yet it's also grounded in one of life's ultimate truths. Everyone eventually runs out of time, even if we can evade the inevitable for a little while. I'm skipping to 10 now. The coin, a stylish Palestinian schoolteacher navigates a cramped New York City where she's obsessing over the large inheritance she cannot access. As chaos consumes her, she vies for control, attempting to cleanse herself of the ways American culture is taking a toll on her. Yasmin Zahir's anxious protagonist becomes addicted to purging herself of filth as she detaches from reality. Back again to 9, the anthropologists. Is there a plot in Asa Gold-Savas's novel? Technically, yes, but it is not really the point. What makes this slim read sing are the intricately drawn ways the husband and wife at its center spend their time with neighbors, friends, and family members. As they view apartments and imagine different futures for themselves, Savas crafts a remarkable narrative about the ordinary moments that fill our lives. Ghost Roots, across 12 short stories, Pemi Aguda asks how we can move forward while being reminded of the past. In a collection brimming with unsettling energy, characters combat ghosts of all shapes and sizes. A woman's horrified when she finds her daughter's face is being overtaken by that of her abusive mother, and an architect is tasked with remodeling a home that keeps changing because of the spirits trapped within its walls. And I did read all 10 of those books of the fiction category by Annabelle Uterman. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.